session number 17643, reel 3.
Mr. Morton, reel 3.
Yes, and as I was about to say, he was also taciturn. He didn't say a word. He looked at this tree stump. He walked round it, looking at it from various angles. Then with one hand he lifted up one side of it and hurled it onto its back, which, as I say, it took several people when we were doing it, and walked round it again, looking from various angles, then just held out his hand for the axe, which was passed to him. He didn't take a wild swing. It was just almost a little tap, and the tree stump fell into two equal halves. It was astonishing. Then he just handed the axe back to somebody and walked out without a word. It was a real act, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, 9C. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, yes, the bunks. The bunks were in three tiers. On very flimsy uprights. The three bunks were just longitudinal strips and bedboards laid across. Bedboards were short planks, which were the basis of the bed. We had a straw mattress on top, of course, and two blankets, which were very well worthwhile. But they were not strong. And every now and again, in the middle of the night, there'd be a sort of a creaking noise and then a rush. And the poor chap in the top bunk would be dislodged completely. He and his eight bedboards and his blankets, of course, and all his belongings, books, tins of food, everything else, would crash onto the men in the middle bunk, who again, of course, with all his paraphernalia, would go through and crash onto the poor men in the bottom bunk. And so there'd be three bodies, masses of tins of food, books and everything else, and a few blankets struggling on the ground. And, of course, it was blackout conditions. There was not a glimmer of light. And you'd hear all these groans and expletives. And eventually they'd drag themselves away and find a table to lie down on. It was all good, clean fun. I mean, everyone had a good laugh over that each time. But eventually we were moved to Sargon. I'm so sorry, I've gone back, haven't I?
Was that at Bad Salza?
This was at Bad Salza, the three-tier bunks. Sargon were much more civilized, two-tier bunks, and... oh, gosh, I am getting things in a mess, am I not?
That's all right. You've cleared it up.
Right. Sargon, of course, everything was much more civilized. We were in combines. It was most convenient to have a combine of 10 because there were 10 to a table. My combine was called Niggler's Nest. The next one to us was HMS Repulsive, and those were the only two that I got to know very well. We arranged things so that one cooked and one did all the sweeping up, or sometimes two people, depended on the combine, how you worked it. But we were very clean. Tables were scrubbed every day, floors were really properly swept and everything else. It was a very good camp in that respect. And it was there that we started, or that a friend of mine, H.W. Bradley, started the Department of Written Music. Now, it was a very necessary thing to have, because we had a lot of music in the camp. There was a small symphony orchestra. There was a big band, dance band type of thing. There were innumerable quartets and quintets and smaller combinations of both vocal and instrumental. There was a church choir, a secular choir. And for any musical show we put on, there was a 30-piece pit orchestra. We'd built our own theatre, and it had a sizable pit. We'd insisted on that. And all that music, of course, had to be written out, written or transposed, or composed in the case of new music for the musical show. Usually had unknown music written in the camp, and so three or four of us were kept working 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think we had Sundays off, so 6 days a week. And it was all high-speed work because, well, high speed, not all that high speed, but very beautiful work. We tried to make it as near as possible to the printed score because, of course, our instrumentalists were not, they were mostly amateurs. They wouldn't have been able to handle what I call dot and slash manuscript. They wanted to see what they'd been used to seeing. I did one long job. It was the Jupiter Symphony of Mozart. I don't know how many pieces there were, pieces of music, but our first violins needed four copies, second violins the same, and all the other stuff had to be either copied or sometimes transposed because we didn't always have the right kind of instruments for a certain thing. A clarinet in A, for example, might be asked for, but we only had a B-flat clarinet, so you'd have to transpose the music for him. And, in fact, to my annoyance, the Jupiter Symphony was never used because we were shifted. We were moved to another camp. The new camp was Stalagluft 6 at Heidekrug. Well, as we were starting a new camp again, we were able to organize things to our own convenience. The theater there was absolutely magnificent. It had everything. And the shows we put on were really quite considerable. The first thing, I think, as we arrived in the autumn, was a pantomime. And somebody came to me and said, would you be the genie in the pantomime? Well, I knew that the pantomime would mean a lot of work in the music department. I really wouldn't have time. So to let him off lightly, I said, only if I can make my entrance through a star trap. And a week later they said, would you like to come and try the star trap out? They'd made one. It was the most wonderful arrangement. Under the stage, they'd got a platform for me, sliding up in guides. Attached to the four corners of the platform were four ropes made out of plaited red cross string. They went over four pulleys made from red cross tins and merged into two ropes going right along to the side of the stage, where they merged again into one enormously thick rope down over a pulley, under a pulley, up to the roof of the theatre and down to where a sack was hanging, which had been arranged to be just equal to my weight plus the weight of the platform that I stood on. And standing ready to jump down onto this sack were our two all-in wrestlers. Tiny Bushell was one of them. I can't remember the other one's name. And when the time came for me to appear, of course, they leapt from where they were standing onto this sack and went down very rapidly, and I went up even, well, just as rapidly, and usually finished up, it shot me into the air. I went up about 3 feet, I think, above the stage level. Yes, there was no star for me to burst through because nobody could see the stage from where they sat. It was always just above eye level. So they didn't need the star itself. Anyway, that was just one of the little things that we had. Shows were going on all the time. Musicals, straight plays, band concerts. There was plenty of entertainment in that camp. The thing we were really working towards was going to be the Mikado. We'd been rehearsing that for quite some time. Naturally, it needed the choir and musical people and actors as well. Everyone was working on the Mikado for some weeks. And then it was almost ready to be put on when the Germans closed the theatre. It was a thing they did quite frequently as a reprisal if we'd annoyed them in any way by having an attempt at escape or something like that. And so the theatre was closed. It was due to open in another few days when it was burnt down. One night we woke up with people tramping through the hut, and everyone was working on the... was going out to try to help this fire. I mean, nobody wanted the theatre to burn because it had been very useful to us. And eventually they got a bucket train. The Germans, of course, brought up a silly little fire engine which didn't do any good at all. It was rather like a garden hose, although rather less efficient. We got a bucket chain going, but all we could do was to save the huts on either side of the theatre by dousing them with water, which we did effectively, but the theatre itself was burnt down.
I think that you later found that it was done deliberately, did you?
That is in effect, yes. We had what was called a canary. That was a receiver, and which had been made from... the guards could be bribed to bring almost anything in, and they had brought valves in necessary for a receiver to be built. The receiver had been kept sometimes in a portable gramophone, sometimes in something else, and once I remember in a piano accordion, which could still be used. And there was one occasion when they were waiting for the news bulletin, and jolly German came in, saw this piano accordion, sat on a table playing it right through the time when we should have been taking the news bulletin, which was very annoying. The news bulletins were the British ones, of course, which were read in every hut in the camp, with always somebody keeping a lookout for any prowling Germans. And eventually it became obvious that we must have a transmitter as well as a receiver, because we knew the British were coming at us from one side and the Russians from another, and we certainly didn't want to be overrun, and we had to tell the British where we were. So there was only one transmitter valve that we knew of anywhere in the vicinity, and that was, of course, in the amplifier in the theatre. So somehow we had to get that. Well, of course, it was easy enough to get it, but if the Germans had found the amplifier was missing its one transmitter valve, they'd gotten on immediately. So the theatre had to be sacrificed and burnt down. Well, it was a wonderful conflagration. The Germans came running in with a little hand-pumped fire engine, which didn't do much good. It was as good as a garden hose, I should think. We made up a bucket train as far as the washhouse, but not to try to put the theatre out. That was out of the question. But we did douse the neighbouring buildings in water to prevent them catching fire from the theatre. And from then on, of course, all we could do was barrack shows. But some of those were very good. Brad formed a triple quartet, vocal quartet, and he arranged dozens of well-known songs and lesser-known songs for them to sing, and they did very well. Other people did comic acts and that sort of thing. In fact, shows went on in all the barracks most of the time. So eventually we were moved from Luft 6 to Torun in Poland.
Before you go on to Torun, can you say something about Dixie Deans and his leadership in the camp?
Dixie Deans was the most wonderful chap. He did get an OBE, but we all felt it should have been something better, if not a knighthood. From the beginning, he had been in contact with Britain. He organized everything. He had, of course, several cronies around him who were also in on this. And he organized the escaping club so that there weren't two people trying to escape at different places at the same time, that sort of thing. Nobody was interfering with another. He was sending messages to Britain. He had his own code, which must have helped the war effort considerably. And when eventually we were released from the camps, he managed to get hold of a bicycle, a ramshackle thing. We were split up into contingents of about 1,000 men in each, and he was cycling from one to the other, arranging for barns for us to sleep in, or arranging everything on his own. But that comes a little bit later. We'll go back to Toruń in Poland. This was an army camp, very much an army camp. There must have been several thousand army people there, and naturally we thought that they would take charge. But when they'd heard Dixie organizing us, they said, oh, well, that's the leader we want too. And Dixie Deans became the leader of the whole camp, which was by then Stalag 357. We were no longer a Luft. It was, as I say, very much an army camp. We couldn't get our own entertainments people going at all. We didn't even try much, but things were going reasonably well until finally we were moved once again. The last move was to Fallingbostel. Fallingbostel was a gloomy place. It was overshadowed by huge warehouse-like buildings, and everything was miserable, except that after we'd been there a few days, they opened up an extra field. It was also surrounded by barbed wire, of course. And this huge field, we found in it the screens that had been used in our last journey. Of course, our journeys were all in railway wagons, and they were the French ones, a 40 homme, 8 chevaux, 40 men or 8 horses. But of course, the 40 men in our wagons were 20 in each end and half a dozen guards in a middle section, so that we were rather cramped first room, but still we managed. And as I say, at Fallingbostel we found a field where they'd put all these barbed wire wooden screens that they'd used to barricade us off from the guards in the middle section. They were all just piled up, higgledy-piggledy, and of course the wood was fuel. So everyone was jumping up and down on these to break them up and carrying the stuff back into the camp. Well, our combine, my small combine, by then it was not Nicholas Ness, it was a few people only. We also gathered a handful each, and we started off towards the wire, and the other two thrust their armfuls into my arms and said, look, we'll go round by the gate, we'll stand inside, throw the stuff over the wire to us. Well, I went up to the wire and waited for them to appear. They didn't. And I started throwing it over anyway, nearly brained somebody. They were the first lot, but still. And then I was tossing it over the wire one by one, and the people inside, not my friends who'd been stopped at the gate anyway, said, look out, Germans. Well, I'd seen a contingent of Germans coming up the main road towards the camp, but they were quite some distance off. And I said, yes, all right. I know they're there, and I went on pushing this stuff through the wire now, and eventually I turned to run for the gate and found just behind me there was a long, slim German leaning on a bicycle and holding a little plated automatic at my chest, at my stomach. Naturally he marched me off to the commandant, who was quite decent. I'd already done, oh my gosh, I never mentioned my first escape, did I?
So finish this story, then you can go back to that.
Well, the commandant was quite decent. He gave me a, only a couple of days, I think, in the clink, and that was that. Now,
can you go back to the story of your escape attempt?
Yes, indeed I can. Now, that was, of course, from Luft 3. I saw a lorry coming into the camp. It came in once or twice to take out the tree stumps that weren't used, wanted for fuel. I don't know why, but some of them weren't. And a few Kriegers loaded these up onto the lorry, and then it steamed out. And I realized there was quite a lot of space underneath the lorry. So the next time it came in, I put a couple of tins of food in my pockets, crawled underneath the lorry, and settled myself down on the chassis. But unfortunately, one of the guards in the boxes on stilts must have had his binoculars out, because although he was a long way off, he must have seen me, because the thing was stopped even before it got as far as the gate. And there was a lot of shouting, and I had to crawl out ignominiously. Of course, I was put in the clink. And that was absolutely glorious. You must realize that I had been living for the last few years with 150 other men in the same hut. And to find myself in a room on my own was sheer bliss. Conditions were all right. I mean, I had this tin of food that I'd shoved in my pocket, and, oh, everything was wonderful. I even met a couple of men who were on my cousin's squadron, the cousin I mentioned who went to Cranwell long before me. And he, of course, by now was a group captain. And he was these were two men on his squadron. They'd also been captured. He had too, but I didn't see him again, not till later. And so my idea of clink was very much removed. I haven't been in prison since I came back to England, but I have no fears of that. Now,
was that the only escape attempt that you made?
There was a tunnel at 9C, but that was rather a footling attempt. Well, it was quite a good one. I joined it when it was halfway built. It was under a bed. There was a vertical shaft of about 8 or 10 feet, and down at the bottom the tunnel led off, and it turned after a bit, and then it went down a bit further, and then it came up, and then it turned the other way. Obviously they'd been not quite sure which way to go to get to the wire. Must have had people shouting down from above. Well, that was as far as it had got when I started on it. But we went down in turn with a Red Cross box and a scraper, and took a bit more off of the working face, as it were. When the box was full, we came back along the tunnel, pushing the box in front of us, and then somebody else would take our place. Now, with the tunnel, always the great difficulty is getting rid of the spoil. How you can get rid of it without it being obvious that somebody's been doing some digging somewhere. Well, just outside that particular hut was the Tagsabot, the daytime lavatory. The lavatories at 9C, well, in fact, all the camps, consisted of a seat with 8 holes in it, facing another seat with 8 holes in it, just above the cesspit. So people were just taking boxes after dark, because we were allowed to go as far as that, even in the dark, taking boxes of soil out and tipping them down the first hole they came to, until eventually somebody tipped one down a hole that was occupied by an old Serb. And I think he must have complained to the Germans, because it was very shortly after that that they discovered the diggings, and that was that. Incidentally, I must tell you about this wonderful system of eight holes facing 8 holes. We had that again. No, it was at 9C. I noticed we were all amused by the fact that when a Frenchman came down in the morning to use the lavatory, he would first walk up one row of people sitting and down the other, shaking hands with each one. Bonjour, Bonjour, Gustave. Bonjour, Monsieur, if he didn't know your name. And shaking hands with all of them before he took his own seat was very, very polite. Now...
You mentioned, I think, at this particular camp, Bad Sulza, this homosexual, I think you called him Fairy Evans.
Fairy Evans, yes.
How, in those days, were homosexuals treated by the other POWs?
By the other POWs, well, he was just accepted. Of course, he was illegal and all that sort of thing, but in the camp, that didn't matter. He must have had to conceal it when he was in England. But, no, it was all open and above board. He wasn't a practicing homosexual. Apparently, in the army barracks, there were plenty of practicing homosexuals who didn't stop at all, but we didn't know too much about that. We just heard.
I think that you more or less implied that you were liberated from Fallingbostel.
Well, not exactly liberated. We were marched out of the camp. Obviously, we realized that things were coming to a head, and then they suddenly said, tomorrow you leave. Well, of course, everyone started then frantically making up harnesses by which they could carry as much as they possibly could, because everything that we left, of course, we lost. And there were wonderful things that were left. Beautiful violins, piano accordions, all that sort of thing in the way of instruments. Books galore. Some of them were facsimile first editions and so on. One hut was full of clothing, which was all brand new. Underwear and that sort of thing, because, it was ready for the next winter. But anyway, we were marched out eventually, as I say, in columns of about 1,000 people and in different directions. But Dixie rounding us all up and, as I say, he kept a fatherly eye on all of us. Then we were shot up at a place called Greece. A squadron of typhoons saw us, assumed we were German, and just dived on our column and sprayed us with machine gun bullets, cannon fire, and rockets. Most unpleasant. And several people were killed, about 30. I've heard 50, but I think it was about 35. And Dixie was furious about this. He went cycling off to... managed to get permission to take a German with him and go through the lines to the British lines. And they did that. They went through, I think on foot. Got to the British lines. He found out where the British general was, who was organizing a whole attack. And he walked into his room and said, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" This was an NCO addressing a general. But when he'd explained why he was there, the general said, "Yes, well, it's a dreadful thing to have happened. We'll make sure it doesn't happen again. Now, you're free now, aren't you?" And he said, "No, certainly not. I'm in charge of these prisoners. Besides..."